If it's true in fingerprint and DNA, let me assure you that it happened across forensic domains. I'll give you a case from the United Kingdom, from London, a serial murderer, not very common in the UK, we take them very seriously, it happens very rarely, follows young women in a car, and then he parks a car and goes behind them and kills them with a blunt instrument. We're not sure even what it is, if it's a baseball bat or a hammer, and kills them, doesn't steal their money, doesn't rape them, just kills them. And CCTV, closed circuit television, very popular in the UK, captured the car of the murderer. But it was a very old camera that doesn't take very pictures very quickly, so it did only one frame of the car. This is the car of the killer. Experts look at it and can identify the car, but there are 27,000 cars, so it's not very helpful, but the registration plate is this. So this is given to two expert imagery experts, and they look at it without a context, and they say what you're supposed to say, I have no idea. Not only they say I have no idea, they say that the characters are here are 7 rows of pixels, and the minimal is 9 to make an identification. But then the police find Levi Belfield, a guy who may or may not done it. He's definitely a scum. I can tell you a lot about him. And they are convinced that it's him, and they go back to the experts and give them the registration plate of Levi Belfield and ask the forensic examiners to reanalyze, to re-look at the evidence, and behold, they can make quite a lot out of this license plate suddenly, because they know the license plate. And they're dedicated, hardworking, motivated forensic examiners. To understand this phenomenon, we really do not have enough time, because we have to talk about the human brain and understand the mechanisms involved in perception. I have a paper called Perception is Far from Perfection, and if I have to explain in a nutshell, we all have, or many of us, a naive view that we see the world the way it is. But the human mind is not a camera. A cornerstone of intelligence, of expertise, is filtering information, interpreting information, and we are very dynamic and flexible in how we process information, what we want to see, what we expect to see. And you all know when you go to an airport and you're waiting to somebody, you make mistakes. You all know when you don't want to see somebody, you see them everywhere. It's the way the brain works, and I do not have enough time to really to get into detail, even if I had an hour to do that, and I have only a few more minutes. Confessions also, you find out that 1/4, 25% of the people who have been exonerated based on DNA confessed to the crime. And confession is very, very powerful. And that will apply across the board to any kind of evidence. What is interesting is not only that the contamination happens from the detective, for example, but it happens from one to the other. So if the fingerprint examiner knows that there's DNA to incriminate the person or vice versa, that is potential contamination, because we require independence and the same across and between all forensic domains. And between them, the eyewitness doesn't need to know that the person confessed, or when you're trying to get a confession, you don't need to say, well, we have eyewitnesses against you and we have forensic evidence. All of this distorts the system. It all comes together as a detective, but each one of those lines feeding in is independent, and all these red arrows introduce a lot of contamination. I put a green line because it doesn't mean there cannot be communication. Some information is needed. A fingerprint examiner may need to know that the fingerprint was lifted off a knife, because it affects how the knife was held and the pressures and the distortions. So there is information that needs to be provided. Some does not, and the information that is provided, you must have the training and the procedures to minimize the contamination. Think about a medical doctor. You go to a medical doctor, and they have an hypothesis. They send you to a blood test, to a urine test, to a CT test, but they don't tell the person who's doing the blood test, I think this person has cancer. They say, no, I need to know how many red blood cells are in the specimen. Sometimes they do. In some complex CT, they need to say what they're looking, because it may affect the contrast used in the scan. But this is a lot of issues that are quite dangerous, and I think the I'll talk about the Willingham case in a minute, if I have any time. So we want to take them out. We want to minimize. When you extract information, you affect the information itself. And you have to be very careful, and this is a big problem. We want to make the evidence stronger. It's all about making the evidence stronger, and to do that, it needs to be independent. Not to the judge, not to the jury, not to the prosecutor, not to the detective, but for the eyewitness person, for the forensic examiner, they don't need the entire context. If they need some context, in DNA analysis, there's a lot of context that they need to have. You can give it to them, but you need to take measures to minimize the potential contextual influences that happen. In the Willingham case, you've already heard a lot how there was potential contamination of the eyewitnesses and how they revised statements as a result of this kind of issues. This is the psychology of violating evidentiary independence. The evidence needs to be collected independent from one another, and then the decision maker, be the judge or the jury, the prosecutor or the detective, can weigh them all together in any subjective way they want to do. It's up to them, but it's not up to the different lines of evidence to do it properly. They must be independent. The Willingham case, in my view, represents the forensic problems exist, but they're rare. They're not happened all the time. Forensic evidence is generally very good, but the break of evidentiary independence, I believe, happened all the time in many cases across the country. And this is, for me, the lesson that we can take, because I don't think we're going to be facing an arson every day, frequently. But this issue, I think, is what I take from the Willingham case to illustrate the importance of this issue. This is where it's all gone wrong. Thank you very much.